Okay, it's recording now. We name is Jonathan Gerland. I'm with Ellen Temple. We are at Mount Pisgah Cemetery in North Boggy, and today's date is June the 8th, I believe, 2018. We're at the cemetery, and we've spent a wonderful morning already looking at nature and seeing the wildlife and all the plants and animals above ground and below ground, and so we're just going to visit a little bit, and some of this will be for the book that I'm working on, but I don't know where you want to begin, Ellen, but I wanted to talk a little bit about what we were talking about earlier, about how you and Buddy and the foundation and looking at a management philosophy, and you were talking about managing for diversity. So if you could just speak to that.
Well, that from the beginning, Buddy wanted to... he wanted this opportunity to manage for all the species in East Texas. He didn't want to just manage for deer. He didn't want to just manage for turkeys. He didn't want to just manage for pine. You know, he saw this as an opportunity to manage these 19,000 acres for all the plants and animals of East Texas. And there's such a diversity of terrain. You know, you got the bottomlands, you've got the uplands, all the different soils, and there's a tremendous amount of diversity. We don't have an inventory of all the plants that are here, but I think if you took a count, it would probably be one of the most diverse stretches of land in East Texas. So he saw it as a big opportunity, but he cared most about the land. He cared about it whether we were in South Texas, you know, our yard, whatever. He really cared about the land and the plants and whether it was healthy or not. And so he that would be his first goal for this conservation area, is taking care of the land. And so right now, all the burning and the different work that's going on is taking care of the land. And it's going to take some years to bring the understory grasses and forbs back, you know, to make it healthy again, where it can sustain itself. And it's off to a good start. Company had done a lot of burning, but now it's done on a, you know, very serious level. Still a working forest, but it's selectively harvested, you know, largely. And just a great opportunity to, manage the land so that quail could thrive here again, and turkey, and all the birds, Bachman sparrow, all the things. The red-cockaded woodpecker, so many of the birds that have pretty much disappeared from East Texas, could have a home here. And then another goal would be for, that Buddy had in mind, and he had started this work way back with a foundation grant to the Stephen F. Austin State University for a Forest Institute, because he said, what we need is a... a voice for the forest. And we need the kind of research on the land that tells you what the best practices are to create that kind of diversity and maintain it. And so the research portion of the mission is a very important one.
Focus on the land from the land's perspective, not from a forest products,
exactly,
industry perspective.
Yeah, on the land's perspective, you know, on its diversity. It's still a working forest, but it can be managed so that it's sustainable.
So when you say working forest, that's mostly income producing?
Yeah, mostly selectively harvested.
And pine?
Would be not the hardwoods.
Okay.
No, not hardwood. But still harvest it. but in a very light manner. And that's just the reality in East Texas. I mean, people, you know, they expect to make a living with their land, but we hope, and Buddy hoped, and the board of the foundation hopes that they can learn from the practices here and the research that we do what would be the best practices for a working forest and still have the diversity, the wildlife, and the sustainability of the forest. I mean, what does it take? And another component besides caring for the land and doing the research on the best, you know, to discover the best practices, will be to educate people. And, you know, the foundation hasn't determined how best to do that. I mean, I think the thought is that you focus on the educating the teachers, the managers, you know, the people who reach other people, the teachers who reach the children. And how we do that and work the, keep it as a working forest, as a research area, and as a, teaching opportunity, that remains to be decided. And but those are the goals.
Okay. And all the while, you've got, whether it's Sons of Boggy Slough or, not, yeah, Sportsmen of Boggy Slough.
Right.
On the south end, and you got IP on the north end that's very heavily deer hunting focused.
Right.
So, how, you know, that's got to be balanced in there too.
Exactly.
And so,
exactly. So that's a factor that, and the, as we move forward, would be under consideration. I mean, how do you, what do we
right.
do with that? And what we learned, we went to Itchaway. Robert and...
is that in Georgia?
Yeah, that's okay. In Georgia. And we went to discover what they were doing. And what we took away from that was, take your time. Do it right. You know, take your time. And so I know people say, well, you know, when are you going to open it up to the public? And when are you going to do this? When are you going to do that? We don't know. Because we want to take our time. We want to do it right. And honor this great legacy. I think Buddy considered this conservation area probably the biggest, most important legacy that his family will leave to East Texas. I mean, and so he was... it was one of the happiest moments of his life in, it was in 2014, I think, January 2014, when he was able to sign the papers for the foundation, as chair of the foundation, to preserve this land and put all of it under a conservation easement.
Where did he sign the papers?
At home. At the home. Dining room table.
Dining room table.
Yeah. He was being treated for cancer at the time. And
did he sign them as soon as he got them, or did he savor it?
He savored it. I got a picture. I've got it on one of my phones, you know, somewhere.
Yeah.
It was a very special picture. And then we did, you know, a lot of...
Was it just you and him?
No, it was the attorneys.
Okay.
Well, Amy and Jack. Yeah, we had another... I think there were a couple other people there. And, we celebrated.
Yeah,
he was very excited. And I know, I mean, the foundation does wonderful work, and this is an important piece of it. But for his personal satisfaction, this was a highlight.
We may come back to some of those days. But we'll kind of go back in time.
Okay.
I'm just curious, what is your first memory when you ever heard the first time Boggy Slough? do you have any connections or memories of it or knowledge of it before you knew Buddy? I'm just curious. I mean, you grew up here and went to Lufkin High School, and sooner or later, did you ever hear of it or know of it?
I don't think I knew about Boggy until Buddy's cousin, Carolyn Allen, was getting married in Lufkin, and she invited me to come out, to join the wedding party and come out here for a supper.
After the wedding?
No. This was before the wedding.
Oh, okay.
And then the rehearsal dinner and then the wedding.
Okay.
And that was my first experience.
Now, when
and
was
it
that?
Was at night. That would have been probably in 1963.
63, okay.
Because I was still in college at the university.
So that was at the clubhouse?
That was at the clubhouse.
Okay.
Before it burned.
I think it was 66 maybe it burned.
I think so.
Okay. So 63.
It was 63 because I was still in college. And so that was my introduction to Boggy. And, it was at night when we came out. And so I didn't really get to see much. But in 1970, when Buddy and I dated, I was a widow and his young son. And Buddy said, I want to show you Boggy. So he took me out to, their family cabin.
What's that? Lodge was Little Boggy?
Yeah, Little Boggy.
They're on Black Cat Lake. The lake, yeah.
And the lodge long, burned long ago. Four years before that. So this was 1970. And so he said, come on, we'll go out, and I want to show you Little Boggy. And so Little John, and
so I guess he
was still
three.
Two. No, he was almost three. He was
okay. Yeah, he and I got a birthday close to each other in August. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we came out, and he had a canoe there at the cabin, and we paddled a canoe with Little John, and I just remember the wonderful, peaceful feeling that I had.
You remember about what time of year it was?
Well, yeah, it would have been in the spring.
Spring of 70, okay.
Yeah, spring of 70, because we married in July 2nd, and then John's birthday was in August. So we paddled around. That was, I think, my introduction to what became one of my very favorite birds, and that was the belted kingfisher, because they were up on the stobs, chattering. And, so a couple little alligators and some nutria. Back then, we had nutria until the alligators grew up and ate all the nutria. And we didn't fish. We just paddled around and enjoyed the quiet. And it was very special introduction. We sat on the porch. Back then, there was a fence, around the little cabin.
Is it a picket fence?
No, it was wire.
Wire. Okay.
Wood and wire, and then it had a sty, the steps
over.
And I know Little John just loved climbing those steps.
Were there cattle in here still?
No, but I think that was probably to protect from the hogs.
Okay.
I'm guessing. But it was pretty much the same porch, smaller, and we sat on the rocking chairs and just enjoyed the evening. So that was a pretty wonderful introduction, and I could tell that Buddy really loved the place.
Was the fire pit still there?
The fire pit was there. It's got new brick now. It just crumbled, but the fire pit was still there. We spent every... since we were married in 1970, we spent every single Thanksgiving there and continue to do that. And our family and Buddy's sister, Shotzi, and her family, and then his dad and Lottie. And it was fun, because we were just a small group, and then it just grew and grew and grew.
Your family.
But when sometimes we even spent a couple Christmases there in the cabin. And I remember going out with Buddy and Arthur, and we took John. I think we had Whitney. I mean, yeah, Whitney, Buddy's daughter, and went out in the woods to get a pine tree.
For a Christmas tree?
For a Christmas tree. They're not easy to decorate.
Oh, yeah.
But they smell good. And we would get a pine tree. We'd get greens. You know, we'd get holly with the red berries on it. Bring that into the house. And use what we could get from the woods to decorate. No plastic. No plastic in the house. Just the natural.
None of that tinsel stuff that was so popular in the 70s.
It was, we just
silver tinsel.
Yeah, well, we did some of, the kids wanted to do some of that, but we always used a real tree.
Icicles, I think they called it.
Yeah.
When we were kids, we used icicles.
Yeah.
Made a mess.
And that was fun to go in the woods and get your own tree. And then I remembered that we also went looking for rich lighter pine. You know, the kind that you find a stump.
Yeah.
And then you could chop a chunk of it and then chop it into kindling. Buddy used to chop it into kindling, and then we use that to start our fires. And that was fun, you know, to go through the woods and look for rich lighter. And I know the first time I smelled it, you know, it smells so strong.
Real
I was just
rich.
Stunned. Very rich lighter. So over all the years, Buddy shared what he loved about Boggy with our family. And we still feel very tied to this place and are so grateful that we have a little piece of family land. It's separate from the conservation area. But so we're so very grateful that we can continue to enjoy it, and our children's children can enjoy that piece of land.
How has the forest changed? You know, we use that word. I guess what I'm getting at is more of a landscape question. You know, what you've seen, the understory, the size of the trees, or not. Since 70 to now, I guess that's what, 48 years of history there. Have you noticed anything that you can comment on, or some observations about changes? Or,
well, the there were a lot. I mean, there weren't as many small trees. They hadn't grown up yet. A lot of these are just like 60, 75 years old. So they would have been small then. So there were a lot of big trees, and it was more open. It's starting to open up again, but it was more open
in 70 than now.
Yeah, and when we drive through, I could hear the quail calling, and that was a thrill. Quail calling, and occasionally see a turkey crossing the road. So that it was more.
Now, they tried to stock some in the mid-70s, didn't they? Did they stock some out here, or was that other places?
Well, maybe they did. I wasn't familiar with that.
But in 70, you remember? I mean,
they did stock some quail.
Okay.
And I guess maybe they did stock turkey. I know they tried quail, but the habitat wasn't quite right. And I don't think they did that until the 90s, but a lot of the understory had grown up. And if it's too dense, you know, quail can't make it. So, in that sense, you know, it's come full circle in a way. Because now, with all the burning that Robert's doing out here, it's opening it up again. And really setting the table for the return of the quail and so many species that require that kind of open understory.
Maybe we can hear the wind.
Maybe that'll show up
the
on the tape. Wouldn't that be nice?
We can hear that wind blowing through the pines.
Oh gosh, this is beautiful.
Feels good, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You can hear it and see it before you feel it.
Yeah. beautiful. So this has been a special place for our family, all of our family, you know, the extended family, for many, many years. Many, many years. And when, you know, Buddy grew up in these woods, and at the end of his life, he was back in the woods. I'm very happy to be here. Very happy to be here. So, besides
the family gatherings around the camp or the clubhouse and those kinds of activities, as far as saying getting out, were there any favorite things that he liked to do, favorite things you like to do? Just,
well, I mentioned, you know, hunting for the rich lighter pine, mm-hmm. and cutting our Christmas tree, you know, just loblolly pine. Try to get the fullest one. And occasionally, you know, like I remember we were all gathered on the porch, and here came some of the guys up to the porch, and they had captured a little wild hog. Little piglet. Brought him up to the porch. And one of our favorite things to do was to go for walks and just enjoy, you know, the hollies and all the different kinds of trees and the birds. And then a real highlight was when the eagles came back. And after they banned DDT, the eagles regrouped and they started nesting. And we had a nest in Boggy Slough at Black Cat Lake. And that was a thrill. I remember Buddy said, I never thought in my lifetime I would see eagles back in East Texas. And now they're thriving. So it's amazing how a small thing like banning, I mean, it seems it's a big thing, but banning a pesticide like DDT, how it can affect the environment, and reintroducing fire to the forest, you know, what a positive turn in the health of the forest that it's made. So it's amazing how you learn as you do, and we want to learn more.
You were saying earlier that Buddy said something along the lines of, if we manage for the birds, we'll be doing good.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more to that, or did I?
No, that's...
Did I say that right?
Or? Yeah, he said, yeah, if we manage for the birds, it'll affect all the forests.
All the other creatures.
All the other creatures. And
So don't manage for deer. No. Don't manage just for this or for that.
Right.
But for diversity,
right,
which all that would be included,
right, and this is a fire dependent ecosystem, and so managing for the birds means burning,
right, and don't put out corn for the deer, but manage the whole 19,000 acres
for food,
which would become in essence a food plot, that you'd have a 19,000 acre food plot instead of a, you know, 100 different deer stands with corn feeders at them.
I think that's what Cliff Shackelford said, you know, that the whole forest is a food plot. Which that's the way it should be.
Yeah, which we were kind of going back earlier to how the mindset changed over 100 years ago when management started focusing on one thing, which led to focusing against something else, whether it be monocropping agriculture or managing for one tree type.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just going to be about pine and then you start pine plantations, or if you've got deer and you start growing more bigger deer, and there's consequences to all those steps and actions.
Right.
And that's kind of been the history, even of this property, especially in those earlier days of cattle ranching for 25-30 years, and
mm-hmm.
and then And then changing to more of a pine philosophy, and you know, before there's a realization of hardwood bottoms and respecting that, and you know, managing to maintain that. And somebody told me once, it was actually a hardwood forester that I interviewed, and we were talking about how Temple did do things differently, and you know, and that was a question I always had. Well, what do you mean by that? And he had said that you know, him being a hardwood management person, which when you talk to someone in the forest products industry and they say management, they're talking about harvesting.
Yeah.
But anyways, he said something along the lines of, he said, you could tell it when you were on a Temple managed land, just stepping on and walking across the land, and the difference was where they introduced the pine. It wasn't, you know, what they cut or didn't cut, it was where they planted.
Mm-hmm.
And that the difference was in a lot of the other operations trying to grow pine, maybe where it was kind of marginal, talking about the bottoms, to get pine to grow wherever it would grow. And you know, naturally at certain places, you know, you didn't have plantations down there in the lowlands, and so that's what they started doing. And now Temple did that on certain tracks, but by and large that wasn't the philosophy.
And they, you know, protected this area.
And Bobby Slew was always a little different.
A little different.
I know Jack tells a good story there about, he said Mr. Temple would always ask him, how many acres do we own? And he'd tell him however many million they owned. And he said, well, I think you can find all the timber you need
without cutting Boggy.
And I think that may help explain some of the more recent, you know, like you said, some of the challenges you were saying, even in 70, it was a little more open even than it is now.
Yeah, it was.
And so I think, again, it goes back to what you were talking about, a balance.
Mm-hmm.
There's that balance that you can't just stay hands off and do nothing for 20 years.
No, that day is past. Well, yeah. Probably, I mean, it's never been hands off.
Right.
I mean, we talked about that earlier. I mean,
some type of
the prehistoric people were,
right.
You know, they were burning or they were somehow manipulating the land to make sure that they had the fruit and the nuts that they needed to eat. And then the Indians did the same, and then the settlers did the same. So it's the, you can't not be involved. I mean, we're part of this forest community. Human beings are. And we have a role to play. And figuring out, I think this conservation area gives us the opportunity to figure out the best role that we as humans can play in this forest community. You know, keeping it healthy, diverse. And when I say healthy, I mean diverse. And
is that some kind of a hawk right there? Yep.
Oh, yeah.
I know, I don't know how long it was, but somewhere along the way, Temple Inland or IP did stop burning for a few years there right before the foundation bought it, because I know when Jack and I drove over it right after the foundation got it, we couldn't even see where the chimney was of the clubhouse that burned in 66.
Yeah.
And we drove right by it and we
couldn't see
the chimney.
It. Uh-huh.
It was so overgrown.
Uh-huh.
There were so many vines.
That was one of the first things Buddy did. Once the
out.
Foundation acquired the land, he opened that up so you could see. And there was a little pond. He called it Buddy's Special Pond.
Yeah, that little one. Yeah.
Way down there, kind of a seep almost.
It was a little stock pond for the livestock.
Oh, was it? Oh.
It shows up on those 33 aerial photographs.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it was down there.
Well, he just loved to go down there and see if he could catch a big one.
I remember him saying that everybody called that big pond Buddy's Pond that they built, I think, in 50. And he said, that wasn't my pond. My pond was the little one that I could go and sneak away from Dad.
Down the hill.
Yeah, it wasn't that far away, but, you know, from a 6 or 7 year old boy, that was
a long way. Yeah.
But I remember he told me that was just a way he could get away from his dad and go down there and try to catch a big one.
Yeah.
He said, that was my pond, that big one. That's just what everybody else called it. But I think what happened was everybody knew that was Buddy's pond, and maybe his dad said, well, I'll build him a pond. They built that big one.
And our kids were lucky to be able to fish. You know, our kids love to fish. And so that's another kind of wildlife, you know, that we have here. although they're actually stocked, you know, but then there's the river, and that's mm-hmm. not stocked. 18 miles of river, although that's, well, that's conservation area, but, you know, on that little bit of family land, it's just 680 acres, I think. You know, we have the opportunity to fish, and the grandkids love it. They just love it.
So what is the, I don't know the role, but, you know, there are certain people that have clubhouses, you know, on the family land. And do you know some of the history of that?
You know, I don't. Okay. I think Jay Shands told me that his dad owned Little Boggy, that little cabin. It was tiny. And when the lodge burned, he offered that to Arthur. So, I guess those who were, I think it was for a club, well, H.J. wasn't an executive of the, I think they must have had that hunting club, and members of the hunting club could build those little cabins. Yeah. And so, there are still quite a few of them.
I know, I guess John McClain has it now, but that was Judge Minton's, mm-hmm. and his may have been the first one.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then Kinley's the one that's right next to it on the left going to his.
Oh, okay.
Of course, Kinley and Minton were brother-in-laws. And so they had the only two, you know, going back to, oh, at least the 30s. And then the one that Trey Denman has now, that was actually the Silvers. He was one of the pasture riders. Mr. Silvers lived there, and then later Grumbles and
mm-hmm.
I forget all the different ones, but they were company employees.
Mm-hmm.
And
And Buddy had the cabin. His cabin was a Rayville
house. Yeah, that was moved. I think Buddy moved it from Rayville to near the where the clubhouse burned. Do you know when that was? Were you already married before? I mean, did he move that after
you
were married?
It was before 70. Okay.
Because they shut the ranch down in the 30s. I don't know, Kinley was still using it up until the 40s, but I don't know. Well, if Buddy moved it, though, it wouldn't have been.
I think Buddy moved it.
Buddy would have had to be in
an
adult.
And that was his little hunting camp.
Yeah.
And then, you know.
He might have moved that after the lodge burned, I bet. 66.
Oh, yeah, because he used to stay in the lodge with his dad. Yeah. His dad had a room on the corner, and then he had a room next.
Yeah, I bet he moved it there afterwards.
Uh-huh.
So it was between 66 and 70, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And then I think just the hunting club was for, you know, it started out, I think, as four executives of, or maybe just good friends of the companies. And or at that time, it would have been good friends of the family, wouldn't it? And then when it became a public company, people who worked for the company,
well,
and that's
think,
how it evolved into a place where some of them, not everybody was a member of the hunting club, had a cabin.
I think somewhere in there was the transition to Scrappin' Valley as more of the company entertainment spot, and this became more of a, like you say, maybe a family.
Yeah.
More than company, whereas this was earlier, always, you know, since they discovered there were deer here.
Uh-huh.
And that there was actually a financial or business benefit to entertaining customers, county judges, you know, lawyers, whoever that was a friend of business.
With the lodge.
And, yeah, and that kind of ended in 66, and,
mm-hmm.
and I guess that, you know, I think they already owned Scrappin' by that time, but there, I think there was a transition.
There was,
Scrappin' was more the company entertainment, and this became more of a family, I guess.
Yeah.
Would that be a fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think, and family and executives. And after it was a public company, it was executives, I think, you know, who had the cabins. But the chili making that they did every year, you know, in February, started there at the Little Boggy Cabin. And then the first time I went to the chili making was in 1971 with Buddy, and that was out at Scrappin'. So I never went to chili making at Boggy. We called it the Boggy Slough, chili making.
But it was at Skagit.
Because, and then, yes, it was a big lodge. Lots of room. And so many people came there. I know Lady Bird Johnson and Liz Carpenter.
Now that was after the Time deal, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah, because that was in
73. Yeah, all the Time executives. There's the History Center has the book.
The guest register. Yeah.
And people came in from all over the country to Scrappin Valley. It was Scrappin Valley. It was different. It was longleaf pine country. This is shortleaf, loblolly country, but it was longleaf pine with clear streams. You know, our streams have a lot of that tannic acid that turns the water brown, but the streams at Scrappin were white as, you know, the sand bars were white, and so those streams flowed clear. There were seeps and pitcher plants, and it was a different. It was longleaf pine country, very different from this. And but oh my gosh, it was beautiful. You could walk through those woods in the fall, along the creeks. You know, it was open. Unbelievable, really. Lots of quail. Very, very beautiful. I was fortunate in my life to be able to see, you know, to experience this kind of forest and also a longleaf forest.
Yeah,
very lucky. Not everybody gets to have that opportunity, so I loved it. I've always loved being outside, grew up outside with my folks, you know, hiking and paddling and still doing it.
you were talking several times before about some of the trips that you would take with your dad. You know, it was that was important to him to take some road trips or like picnics and things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We just he grew up in the northern forest, and he hunted and trapped, and I mean it was the early 1910s. You know, 1915, 16, 17, 18, that time when it was just wild.
Wow.
And
that's when Boggy was just been logged and they were starting the ranch and everything, just some perspective.
Uh-huh.
It was the 10s, yeah.
And yeah.
So that was when your dad he was growing up then, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he was born in 1910, so he was growing up.
Oh, okay, yeah, so the late 10s, yeah.
Yeah. I guess he was probably about 7 or 8 when he started to get out in the woods trapping. But you think about it, the lumber, the paper, that's my family. My dad was paper making, and the Temple family was lumber and also paper later on. But the plants are what unite us, really, in so many ways. I mean, my family, I was in the book publishing business. Well, that comes on paper.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, in a way, we live off the land in a different way than the original people did, you know, the Indians and that. They lived off the land, the berries, the fruits, the nuts, the game, but then it evolved where the humans are still living off the land, but it's a different way of doing it. And our challenge is, you know, for the future is how do we, as our population grows, how do we live off the land in a way that keeps it healthy and sustainable, so it can give us all the gifts. You think about all the gifts that land gives us. It gives us oxygen. The plants give us oxygen. The clean water, you know? I mean, water percolates through these forests. How do we sustain that for the future? And we hope that Boggy Slough will help answer some of those questions.
I keep thinking that we're sitting right here at the cemetery and all these people, these tombstones here,
yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
All the their experiences here, and I don't know if they could have ever imagined that someone would be sitting here talking about such things.
Yeah.
You know, with just the lives that they had and what we're still learning about what they went through and their connections to the land. And
well, Jonathan, I'm driving around with you this morning and learning about the families who settled on this northern part of Boggy Slough, close to the cemetery, you know, down the roads. And there was a school here at Pisgah, and that was just so delightful, you know, to hear about the little girl who loved her home.
Yeah, the little crispy pretty girl. Flowers on the hillside.
Yeah, and
the
birds,
birds
and the trees and the elm trees, and that was.
And it was right here.
Very
I mean,
scary.
It wasn't
right
just abstract poetry. I mean, it was real. That was the real thing.
Right here.
Right here.
And
they went to school here, and
yeah.
Some of those accounts said that it was actually one of Charlie Harbor's older sisters. She was interviewed by a fellow that wrote a book on Kennard, and she said that they would have school going on when they would be having a funeral occasionally, and the teacher, would always pay attention, but if they were really good, the teacher would let them, come out and watch.
Oh.
But they always wanted to see who it was. And of course, it would have been a community thing, too, so nearly everybody would have known who it was, and,
mm-hmm.
A community funeral or whatever. And, but I just keep thinking about, especially those Christies and the hard lives they had and the feuds and the killing and
yeah.
the shooting and those funerals. We just got through walking by the dad and the twin boys that shared the same death date. And
just
to think about, 105 years ago, they were right where we are, burying their daddy and their brothers and just all the strife and everything that was going on with that.
And look at how peaceful it is today. Yeah. But I think living off the land was hard.
Yeah, I mean we hear things about earn a living and working the land, but we don't truly appreciate and understand it because we don't have to.
Yeah,
they had to.
They had to. They had to get it all off the land.
And whether it be the Indians or those settlers, they had to do what it took to stay alive.
Yeah,
and
my appreciation keeps growing for what the challenges that they overcame. To have a life out here in the forest.
You see those photographs, men and women alike, and they look like they're 100 years old or something, and they're in their 40s,
yeah.
And older than their 40s, and just the hard life. And, we take so many comforts for granted, air conditioning and
mm-hmm.
running water and clean sheets probably every night,
yeah.
Just clean clothes and... they had, they pretty much self-sufficient. They still, that's part of that transition period too of, it was even different from the 1850s to 1900.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, 1900 is when the railroad came through here and, that changed a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of the boys were leaving the farms then, going to work to get away from the land. It's kind of ironic. A lot of them ended up still digging in the dirt, whether they work on the railroad or cutting down pine trees for the sawmill.
Yeah.
But, it was a way that they could leave the, even T.L.L. Temple, supposedly left his mule in the field. That's what Arthur Jr. used to always say, that he farmed one day when he moved from Virginia to join his older brothers there in Arkansas. Said he left his plow in the field.
Oh my gosh.
He said, that's not for me.
Have to admire the people who were, who were able to make a scratch a living.
Yeah, exactly. Scratch.
Out of the land. They just had small plots and they somehow managed it. So yeah, I do admire that.
Say, just real quick, you were talking a little bit earlier about the need to have maybe a scientist or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but someone who understood soils, you know, what's going on below ground, as much as, you know, we were talking a little bit about landscape and how that's kind of a outside looking in term, and seeing just, it's visually.
Yeah, the surface.
You know, what you see, the surface, yeah. And
well, we're just starting, and I think that'll be part of the research here is, you know, the life underground is in a forest is like a big tree underground, you know, just sprawls out. And
talking about the roots
And the fungus and the microbes and all the life that goes on the forest floor.
Within the soils.
Within the soil that sustains the trees and the landscape above the soil. And how, over time with intense use, how do you keep that health of the forest floor? You know, respect it and keep it healthy. Those will be questions for the future that we hopefully can discover. So,
I mean, you know, you stop and think about so many little things, like, you know, all the cattle that they had up here, and you think about the soil compaction of the cattle, and then today with big logging machines and equipment, you know, compacting the soil, and the road work that's done, and then mulchers, and, you know, it's all labor saving.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even all of those, you know, your footprints are a little larger and deeper and more, you know, it's totally different than a few dozen people out with mules and mm-hmm. crosscut saws, and when you bring in heavy equipment. And
But they've learned, you know, I know they're doing it Itchaway and Robert's doing it here, you know, trying to manage the logging so it has a lighter impact on the forest floor, you know, protect the floor. And I think we can all learn from those practices, you know, discover the best practices here and then help spread the word. And, you know, it's just restoration is an evolving science. And we have so much that we don't know, especially in East Texas.
And still don't know, I don't think, what to restore back to. You know, when you talk about restoration.
And there's no really going back to.
Your idea may be different than somebody else's.
Well, there's no, I don't think there's any.
Yeah, restoration to what?
Yeah.
And at what level?
Yeah. And with, you know, it, as we said, humans have manipulated.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a virgin forest.
No, they've manipulated it there for a long, long, long time. And at least in this part of this state. Maybe, you know, on the West Coast, there's some redwood forests, I think, that haven't been touched. And so they don't take that kind of restoration. But here, you know, we have an opportunity to do that work on a pretty big scale.
Yeah.
And
it's a good size. It's not too large, but, you know, it's not too small. It's not going to have, you know, impact beyond it either.
Yeah.
And I guess there's always going to be challenges such as Chinese tallow and
hogs.
And hogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what the neighbors do.
Yep.
Or don't do.
Yep. That's a big, because you want it, one strong case for having conservation easements all along the river where they can't, you know, where landowners decide, well, when my kids inherited this, I don't want them to be able to chop it up, to fragment it. I want it to remain intact along the river and protect the river. I think more and more people are recognizing how important that is. And maybe eventually the Neches River on both sides will be protected. I hope so. Because it's better for the river.
Mm-hmm.
much better for the river. So, what we learn here, we want to share. And they're doing that in forests in Virginia and South Carolina, what forests they have left, and Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas. But in East Texas is just late getting to that that discovery phase. I mean, we haven't done a lot of the science here. And so there's a big challenge, but a great opportunity for Boggy to lead the way.
Okay. Thank you very much.